Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. As we speak, we are awaiting an announcement that may have a profound impact on the future of labor and of labor unions in America. Largely responsible for building the middle class in America, labor unions have declined in membership in recent years. Today, that membership is at historic lows, having shrunk to 11% of all workers, down from its peak in the mid-50s of 35%. But this week, that may begin to change. Workers at an Amazon warehouse in Alabama recently took a vote on whether to unionize. The results of that vote are expected this week, and that may set the stage for the next chapter for unions and for labor and for Amazon. Here to talk about all of this is Alina Selyuk. She's a business correspondent for NPR who actively follows the retail and tech industries. Thank you for joining us. Good morning.
Good morning. Hello.
Welcome. Robert Korstadt is back with us. He's Professor Emeritus of Public Policy and History at Duke University's Terry Sanford School of Public Policy. His areas of concentration have focused on 20th century U.S. history and the history of labor. Thank you for coming back. Welcome.
Nice to be here. Thanks, Mike.
And let me begin with you with a little history lesson. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I remember back in the Pleistocene era when I went to school, they talked about guilds coming into being in the medieval times. And I guess you could call that the beginnings of unionization. And I think the first official trade union in this country came about in 1794 in Philadelphia among shoemakers. But when did unions in America really begin to take off?
Yeah, I mean, I think the dawn of the modern labor movement is really in the 1930s, when during the Depression, there was a lot of militancy among workers over a whole variety of issues. And that was all, of course, aided by the passage of the National Labor Relations Act, the Wagner Act, which gave workers the right to unionize and provided a National Labor Relations Board to oversee the larger process. With that came also a new union or a combination of unions called the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, which were, you know, organizing in the big industrial plants. They weren't the kind of modern day craft unions of skilled workers, but these were industrial workers. They organized everybody in the particular plant. And that was really the start of the movement that we know in the United States. And as you say, really blossomed in the post-World War II period.
Do you see parallels to what's going on with the middle class today and what's going on with workers who are increasingly losing the protections that came about in large part due to unions that are leading to some kind of a revival of interest among workers in unions today?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some similarities between what happened in the 1930s and what's happening today. I mean, we've got lots of people who are unemployed or precariously employed. Wages haven't kept up with the cost of living, the lack of benefits that people have. So there's a lot of concern and anxiety, I think, among workers, you know, about their future and about their ability to support themselves and their families. That's generating a lot more interest in unions.
You mentioned the CIO. They would eventually join forces with the AFL, the American Federation of Labor, which came around in the 1800s, and they're coming into being, I think, you correct me if I'm wrong, moved Congress to pass legislation that would give employees overtime pay, a minimum wage, and the right to strike. Did those productions come about at the insistence because of the power of that growing union, or did they come about simply because Congress saw this and wanted to make it happen?
Well, I think primarily the impetus comes from the mass mobilization of workers and strikes and threats of strikes during the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, there's an upsurge in labor militancy. In North Carolina is one example of 1934 General Textile Strike, where we had tens of thousands of workers in North Carolina on strike for almost a month. And I think it was, you know, mass mobilizations like that really prodded Congress to take a look at the kind of archaic laws or lack of laws that existed to protect union rights.
Robert Korstadt is a professor of history at Duke University. We're also with us is Alina Selyuk. She's a business correspondent who follows all this for NPR. And we're talking about this today because of the vote in Alabama last week at an Amazon warehouse that we're still waiting for the results on. Unions have been historically strong in heavy industries like car manufacturing and steel and things like that. But we're talking about union workers at a warehouse deciding to vote or on bringing in a union. We don't know whether they actually did it yet or not. Would this be the first time that workers in a place like that have voted to unionize, or just simply the first time for Amazon to be faced with this?
The latter. It's Amazon. The union here that's trying to represent the workers at this warehouse in Alabama is the Retail Wholesale Department Store Union, and they already do represent some smaller warehouses. I think it's like grocery warehouses and a couple of others, but it's a big deal for Amazon because specifically Amazon has grown into, I think they're now the second largest private employer. They're just behind Walmart. They employ in the United States about 800,000 people, and the vast majority of them are in warehouses. So this workforce for Amazon is fairly new. I mean, in the sort of long arc of the company, it's a fairly new workforce. And in the US, they have sort of avoided unionization in warehouses up until now. They fought it pretty strongly, and they've successfully fought it so far. This particular warehouse, it's in Bessemer, Alabama. It's right outside Birmingham. It is one of the newest warehouses. That's another very fascinating thing. This warehouse opened in March of last year, so it is barely a year old. And the unionization effort kind of surprised Amazon. It came out really fast. Between the time that the workers there reached out to the retail union to the time when they actually petitioned the federal labor officials to trying to unionize, trying to hold this vote, it was just a matter of months. And then another matter of months, they held the vote, which happened just recently here. Now they're calculating this vote. So if this warehouse, which by the way is massive, it mm-hmm. has almost 6,000 people there. If this warehouse votes to unionize, it will be the first unionized warehouse at Amazon, one of the largest employers in the country, in the United States. Amazon does have a union presence in Europe. It's been kind of historically there. In the United States, it will be the first one if the workers vote yes.
Is it likely to be the first domino to fall? In other words, if they vote to unionize in Bessemer, will other Amazon facilities around the country follow suit?
I think that's as far as labor organizers are concerned, they believe that will be the case. They say just the fact that this vote is happening on its own has already prompted really kind of energetic inquiries from other warehouses. The story with Amazon is a bit complicated. There have been efforts to unionize other facilities, much smaller efforts. There was a vote. The last time a union vote took place at Amazon was 2014. So it's been years since even a vote took place. And at that time, it was a really small group of technical workers, about, I think, 27, 30, and they voted against unionizing. So that was not a successful union drive. And since then, it's already a first union vote. And just that on its own, according to union leaders, sort of in the organizing field, they say they've received hundreds of new inquiries from other warehouses, so they know it's being watched. And from that perspective, it could be. They even say, from their perspective, and you kind of have to take it that, but they're saying that in one way, even if the vote is no, if the margin is really close, even that could potentially start a wave. So we'll just have to see how the vote plays out.
What drove these workers to approach the union at this point in time? Why did they do this?
Right. So as I mentioned, it is really new. So there are a few things happening last year. I'm going to bring up the pandemic.
Okay.
The warehouse opened in March, right as the pandemic began. They went on a hiring spree, obviously had to bring on thousands of workers in a really quick pace. And from the way that the workers themselves tell the story, the workers who reached out to the union tell the story, they were saying, you know, they came from unionized backgrounds. So the workers who'd reached out to union had worked previously in a unionized facility. It was not a warehouse, it was a different kind of job, but they'd worked in a union shop before. And when they joined Amazon, they were unhappy and concerned about various things, including the productivity quotas, the pace of work. And then they were saying they were noticing that workers were getting disciplined and kind of confused about how the disciplining was working. Mm-hmm. There was not a lot of clarity and communication. Some of them were frustrated with the fact that it seemed like their relationship with the company was more a relationship with an app and a computer rather than a human manager with whom you can sort of talk it out. Amazon, of course, says, you know, they are proud of the workflow that they've established. They point to the wages that were being paid. You know, it's $15 minimum wage is a pretty high minimum wage compared to the local minimum, which is $7.25 an hour. Mm. So this kind of went on, but the workers reached out to the union saying, the productivity quotas, we want to have a better, more say on it. We want to have more say about how people get fired. You know, we want to have a clearer understanding of the disciplining actions that Amazon can take against workers. And the way that the worker who reached out to the union tells a story, he literally just came home one day and Googled, like, what union can represent Amazon workers. And RWDSU came up, Retail Wholesale Department Store Union. Don't know how. And that's kind of how that started.
These workers voted in March. They began counting the votes on March 30th. Here it is, April the 6th. There were only 5,800 people who voted. What's taking so long? This is worse than the presidential election.
You say it's only 5,800. It's 5,800 people. From what I understand, of course, it's not 100% turnout, so it's probably not 5,800 people who voted. It is a very complicated process, as I discovered. It is not quite like the presidential election, but it was a mail-in vote. So that's one wrinkle, is that they voted by mail because of the pandemic. The process that's happening now that's taking really long, it's a private process, so we don't actually get to see it. But in this moment, for the last few days, what the federal labor officials, the NLRB agents, have been doing is calling out names of each worker who voted and waiting for either union representatives or Amazon representatives to object to their eligibility. So they're going one by one, every voter, sorting out whether the company or the union have objections to their eligibility. After that's done, they will have to open all the envelopes and then they will tally, already anonymized at that point, anonymized ballots. Only then they will tally the actual yes or no votes. This week. Yeah. So the expectation in this moment, and things change, but in this moment that tally will begin, maybe not tomorrow, but maybe Thursday. We're kind of in that day-to-day.
Alina Selyuk is a correspondent with NPR. She's here along with Robert Korstadt. Dr. Korstadt's professor emeritus of public policy and history at Duke University. And when we come back, this is happening in Bessemer, Alabama, this vote that may change Amazon and unionization in America. And the South has an uncomfortable relationship with unions, doctor, and we'll talk about that when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about unions and the resurgence or the apparent possible resurgence of unions as led by these voters at a warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama, run by Amazon. They voted last week, and we're waiting for the result of that vote as to whether or not these 6,000 employees will unionize. We're talking about that with Alina Selyuk, business correspondent from NPR, and Robert Korstadt from Duke University. This vote, as I said, Dr. Korstadt, took place in Alabama. The South has historically been unfriendly to unions, and that's putting it nicely. Is that now changing?
Well, I'm not sure how much it's changing. I think one of the things that's really important to understand about the South is even though the South has the lowest unionization rate of any region in the country, North Carolina has the lowest in the South. The legacy of really of militant union struggles and worker struggles is very much a part of Southern history and Southern labor history. And so it's not, you know, even though the rates are low, I don't think it's the lack of interest and the lack of effort on the part of workers to try to find ways of getting better working conditions, wages, all the things that unions are trying to do. You know, what's true in the South is that employers have been very much opposed to union, largely because most of the industry in the South has been very competitive industry, a low wage industry, a low profit industry. So unionization, employers have seen unionization as a real threat to their profitability and their sustenance. But I think
And would it be accurate to say that those employers in many cases, particularly in the South, were successful in convincing employees it was in their best interest not to unionize?
Yeah, I think that employers have been pretty successful in, you know, and getting workers to defeat unions when they're come up for votes and stuff. But I think also, you know, that there's been the power of the state, the way in which employers have played black workers and white workers off against each other. Now Latino workers, women workers and male workers. I guess the important thing to understand is it's really it's a complicated story that gets, you know, simplified in a lot of different ways. And I think one of the things we're seeing in Alabama right now is a resurgence and some continuity to this long struggle, particularly by African-American workers.
Well, that brings up something I think you told, I think it was the New York Times you told this, it could have been another publication, that whatever the outcome of this vote, this is all part of the tradition called the civil rights unionism of black workers, which combines class consciousness with race solidarity. Explain that.
Yeah, that's a term I coined in relation to a book I wrote on unionization at Reynolds Tobacco Company in Winston-Salem. And it's really an effort and an understanding on the part of black workers that the struggle for labor rights and the struggle for citizenship rights, civil rights, go hand in hand. And you can't really have one without the other. You can't have political rights unless you have some economic security, some economic power. You can't have labor rights unless you have some kind of influence in the political sphere. And I think that these workers in Alabama understand that very well, and they're drawing on both of these traditions, the history of civil rights struggles in Alabama and also the labor struggles.
I understand why companies would try to convince to do anything to stop unions from coming in and try to convince their employers that employees rather that it would be in their best interest not to unionize. But here in this part of the South, in North Carolina and in Charlotte, this whole area was run by textile mills for the longest time. And a lot of the people who worked in those mills owed their soul to the company store, to quote Ernie Ford. Why would they be so suspicious of unions? Because a lot of Southern workers don't like the idea.
Yeah, I think that's a complicated issue. I mean, I think there is a certain amount of a certain kind of individualism. This kind of, it's part of the culture in the South, and that unions are something that seem kind of foreign. There's something that are brought in from the outside. I think that the nature of these factories, particularly in the textile industry, the culture in those factories was very complicated, and there were a lot of tensions and dynamics between workers. There's some evidence that at least the religious traditions in the South and the particular role of evangelical Christianity and the role of the church was another factor that kind of countered the efforts at unionization. I still think, in the long run, it's been the economic and the political and the social power of employers who've had the ability to really put a lot of pressure and threaten and put a lot of fear into workers. That's been the big difference.
From my personal experience, and in the interest of full disclosure, I am a member of AFTRA-SAG, which is the broadcasters union, although I don't use it here because it's a non-union shop. But in places that I have worked elsewhere, not here, elsewhere, where the word union has been spoken, whispered among employees, we were always told, if you're overheard with your whisper today, you won't be here tomorrow. Right. So there is that fear. If it turns out, Alina, that these workers in Alabama at Amazon decide to unionize, is Amazon under any obligation to recognize that unionization or to follow any dictums from that unionization? Or could they just say, okay, we'll just hire 6,000 new people?
I mean, that's a big question. There are rules, right? The National Labor Relations Board does enforce some rules to the interaction between a, legally voted in, procedurally, approved union and the company. But the company, so from everything I've heard, and from everything we know about Amazon, if this union gets a yes vote, if this worker, and this is still an if, right? If these workers have voted to unionize, the efforts to get to that first contract are a very long, very long road. And it's a classic rumor that goes around union election time that, this whole facility is just going to be shut down if this place unionizes. This has gone around at the Bessemer warehouse. A few weeks ago, I was talking to a worker there who said, yeah, that's what the managers are going around. This is a rumor. They're just saying, well, if you guys unionize, Amazon's just going to shut down the whole place and open a different one on the other side of Birmingham. I did ask the company about it. They did kind of just, disown that rumor and, kind of said that this is not a real thing. That said, how long and how painful a potential contract negotiation would be, I think there's no doubt about it. And depends on also what else happens in the context. Are other warehouses attempting to unionize in that, in that same time frame? The history of Amazon and unionization efforts is very complicated in the US by the fact that there have been accusations of retaliation against workers who have attempted to organize their workplaces, both in warehouses and in among the technical workers. The Amazon representatives, of course, say this had nothing to do with the unionization parts or with their labor organizing efforts and had everything to do with these workers' violation of internal policies. For instance, an internal policy about that prohibits speaking out publicly in negative terms about the company. There are restrictions on what you can say to the media, for example, and how you interact with the media as a worker at Amazon. Or during the pandemic, these workers, Amazon says some of the workers were not maintaining social distancing properly or were in the warehouse in a kind of weird spot at a weird time and violated internal policies about safety and security during the pandemic, that sort of thing. But there are ongoing accusations of Amazon against Amazon and claims of retaliation against Amazon with the National Labor Relations Board. And what we're watching for is how the NLRB pursues those cases, whether it decides to pursue them nationally, and whether we're going to continue. You know, I'll spend the rest of the year talking about some kind of nationwide investigation from the NLRB into, you know, Amazon's approach to workers who attempt to speak publicly or organize publicly.
I want to come back to Amazon, what this vote may mean for Amazon and for the future of unions and for the future of labor in America. But I want to also bring it closer to home right now, because just like North Carolina, South Carolina has a strong tradition of worker suspicion of unions. And both states are so-called right-to-work states, which we'll talk about. But the workers at the state newspaper in Columbia recently chose to form a union, the State News Guild. That paper is owned by McClatchy, the company that also owns the Charlotte Observer and most of the other major dailies in North and South Carolina, including the Raleigh News and Observer and the Rock Hill Herald. And joining us now to talk about that vote at the state is Travis Bland, the paper's arts and entertainment reporter. He also covers crime and justice, which is an odd juxtaposition. But Travis, welcome to the program. Nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
What led to the decision of workers at the state to unionize, to choose to maybe hold a vote on unionization?
Yeah, well, we wanted to protect what we have. Last year or so, McClatchy came out of bankruptcy, and we found out we were being bought by Chatham Asset Management, which is a hedge fund. We've seen the damage that hedge funds do to local news organizations. And so we wanted to protect what we have the best way we can, which is through unionization. That's really what I think brought this up. COVID also affected it. We saw layoffs in other sectors of the news through McClatchy. And so the idea got like, well, is this going to come to us? How are our jobs going to be affected? And so, yeah, protecting what we had in this atmosphere is really what I believe brought.
So, did I just hear you say that the state is no longer owned by McClatchy, that it was sold to a hedge fund? Is that what I just heard?
McClatchy is owned by Chatham Asset Management.
Okay. The whole company.
We're still owned by McClatchy. Okay. McClatchy's kind of our managers, and Chatham Asset Management is the owner.
Okay. Other McClatchy papers in South Carolina beat you to the punch in this move. The Hilton Head Island Packet and the Beaufort Gazette voted to unionize in September of 2020. That vote was voluntarily recognized by McClatchy. Was that a catalyst for this movement at the state?
It certainly inspired us. I like our North Carolina, South Carolina disconnect. There's Beaufort in North Carolina, it's Beaufort yeah. in South Carolina. Yeah, it certainly inspired us. There was talks of us organizing as the Island Packet was doing it under the Packet Gazette Guild. And so, yeah, it definitely inspired us. And getting voluntary recognition from McClatchy for them said it proved to us that it was in our best interest and the best interest of like news, local reporting and local journalism to move forward together with the company that owns.
So as I understand it, more than 80% of the workers at those newspapers voted to unionize. How many voted at the state?
Yeah, we have a majority of support. It's overwhelming, for sure. If we were to have to go to an election, we would definitely win it. But we're hoping McClatchy, and we're asking them to voluntarily recognize us so we don't have to do the election part, because McClatchy's mission is the same as the reporters, right? We're here to create quality journalism that reports on our communities. So we want to move forward together in that and not waste our time with actually going to an official election.
I'm tempted to ask the question, do you really share the same mission? Because if McClatchy is owned by a hedge fund, is that what they're interested in, or are they just interested in the bottom line?
Well, I mean, you're a company. Like, of course you're interested in making money. I can't speak for McClatchy, but we believe in the mission of reporting on our local communities. We as reporters at the state believe in that. And that's what McClatchy says his mission is, too. We have no reason to doubt that. They act like that. So let's move forward together with voluntary recognition.
You work in an industry, it's no secret, that has been devastated by digital, the shift away from printed newspapers and all that goes with it, the classified ads and the full-page ads, which they used to charge a fortune for, cannot be duplicated in cyberspace. They have not figured out a way to recover that revenue, and that has led to companies coming in and gobbling up a bunch of papers to save them. And then layoffs ensue and reductions in revenue and the reductions in circulation of the printed paper begin to tumble and the thing begins to collapse. Why is now the time to hit owners of newspapers with yet another obstacle, unionization?
Well, they've been putting up obstacles for reporters forever, right? Like this now's the time for specifically all those reasons. We talked to some of our veteran clients, our veteran colleagues at the state. And, you know, they would tell us in 2000, there was over 100 reporters at the state newspaper. It's been declining and declining. We have about 30 newsroom members now. Like, we have to stop the bleeding. So we're using the tools that we have at our disposal, which is unionization.
Shortly after the vote to unionize, the union, the union that your workers formed, the State News Guild, issued this statement, which said, "Our mission is to foster an environment in which the state's journalists can continue producing works of truth, accountability, culture, and compassion without constant worry of professional insecurity. We will fight for a fair deal while striving for a positive relationship with management. Organizing can be adversarial, but it must always be based on respect and understanding. We believe in the state and its mission, and we want it to succeed." That statement mentions the constant worry of professional insecurity. You're talking about job layoffs, correct?
Correct.
How does this prevent that? Because it seems to me if the company is not meeting its revenue goals and it has too much of an overhead, it will have to either lay people off or shut down.
Yeah. Well, we've seen layoffs, but unionization is the best way that we can get any sort of protections for jobs at our disposal. We know we can't stop layoffs. Bad company decisions, because we have a lot of quality reporters here who are very passionate about their jobs, and they shouldn't be losing those jobs. If revenues decline and stuff, we have to find new ways to make revenue. That's what the company does. But what we're saying is we need job protections however we can get them, and that's through unionization.
Your reporters and photographers and newsroom producers want their union to be represented by the Washington Baltimore News Guild of the Communication Workers of America. That's the same union chosen by the Hilton Head Island Packet and the Beaufort Gazette. Given that union's history, what do you anticipate they will do for you or request of the company from management? And let me hold that question in abeyance because I just noticed the clock and we're coming up to a break, which I have to take. So when we come back, we'll talk about what you hope to get out of unionization if this comes to pass. Travis Bland is with us at the moment. He's a reporter for the state newspaper in Columbia. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about unions in America and the future of labor as a vote result is anticipated this week among the 6,000 or so employees at an Amazon warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama. We're talking about that with Alina Selyuk, business correspondent for NPR, and Dr. Robert Korstadt, professor emeritus of public policy and history at Duke University. And right now we're speaking with Travis Bland, a reporter for the state newspaper. That newspaper's employees recently asked for a vote to go union. They are a McClatchy-operated organization, just as is the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer. So what are you hoping to get out of unionization? If the vote goes through, if McClatchy accepts it, if you're accepted into the union that you want to be part of, what do you hope they do for you?
Yeah, well, we just want to protect what we have. We have a great newsroom right now. And we like our working conditions, so we want to protect those. That's really what we want. But we also want a seat at the table for when decisions are made. You know, local reporting is a job you have to do with passion. So when you're asked to do something that you have to put your whole heart into, you should have some place at the table for decision making. So protecting what we have and having a place to be part of the decision making, that's what we want.
I mentioned earlier that usually if there's even a whiff of a desire on the part of employees to unionize, trouble ensues and management cracks down, particularly in southern areas where there's not a tradition of unionization and right to work is held up as a hallmark of southern hospitality, for lack of a better term. Did it take courage for you guys to broach this subject and actually get together and decide to do this?
Well, you know, journalists are probably one of the most courageous bunch out there. They take on people in positions of power all the time. But it was a tough topic to sort of broach, but it was the way we came to it was more inquisitive than controversial. What does this mean for us? How does this benefit us? Things like that. Those were questions we were asking. We weren't asking, oh my God, what are the consequences? What's the fallout? That's not what we were concerned about. Mm. We were just concerned about what, how this could benefit us and would it really be for the best of us?
Like North Carolina, as I mentioned, South Carolina is a right to work state. You don't have to join, even if there are unions, you don't have to join that union, nor do you have to pay dues to that union in order to work. How does that impact any union's ability to collectively bargain if somebody down the hall simply doesn't want to be part of it?
Yeah, well, it doesn't affect it at all. Doesn't matter. I love the law that you read in South Carolina. The first like words it says is, it is the policy of South Carolina. Now, policy is not a law. You aren't beholden to a policy. I was talking to some other journalists earlier. I said, I have a policy too. I want to unionize. I want to protect my job. That's my policy. You know, so it doesn't affect us at all. It's just a scare tactic. And that's been the power of the, you know, right to work policy, is that it scares people. And that's it, though. It's just a scare tactic. It doesn't affect you at all.
Would you agree with that, Dr. Korstad? And if it's a policy in South Carolina, is it also a policy in North Carolina?
It's the language in the legislation is a little stronger in North Carolina, and it makes it, you know, it's illegal for companies to engage in, you know, to sign contracts and collectively bargain with unions in which those clauses are there. The whole history of right to work, it starts in the 1940s and then in the late 1940s, after this whole burst of unionization activity I talked about before, it's very much an attempt to try to weaken the ability of unions to sustain themselves. So it's, you know, the target really is to try to prevent unions from requiring people who work in the factories, who are covered by contracts, who benefit from contracts, from having to pay dues to unions. And if you're any kind of organization and you don't require people to pay for the benefits they're getting, you're not going to be very long lived. It's like, you know, it's like the newspaper saying, well, if you will deliver the newspaper to you, and if you want to pay for it, fine. If not, we'll deliver it anyway, or we're required by law to do that. And I think it's another way to kind of divide workers, keeping, you know, creating those tensions in the workplace. I just want to say one thing that I think Travis brought up, which is this whole issue of control within the workplace or influence in the workplace. I think this is one of the central issues in the Amazon case. It's like, how do you organize work? Don't workers have a right to have some kind of influence in the conditions under which they work, when they take breaks, when they don't take breaks, when they want to do overtime, when they don't want to do overtime? And I think one of the things that sometimes is missing in discussion is these are issues about democracy as much as they are about wages and benefits and things like that. And so I think that, again, I'll go back to my argument about civil rights unionism. The issues we're seeing in Georgia with the voting rights restrictions and issues we're seeing in Alabama are very much tied together, and I think have to be understood as a whole.
One of the things that workers in the South have said about unionization, that if they're not in favor of it, is the fact that they don't want to be told by some organization what they can and cannot do, even though their employers are telling them what they can and cannot do. And they also don't want to have to pay dues in order to work. And one of the arguments that has been historically used by employers who are down-talking the unions is that they just want your dues. They're not really going to help you. They just want your money. And that is one of the arguments, I believe, Alina, that Amazon used in Alabama. How did that go over down there?
That's exactly the argument that Amazon has been using. They have a slogan. It's called "Do It Without Dues." And they've put that slogan everywhere. It's all over the warehouse. It's on banners and then little leaflets on the tables. A lot has been said about this bathroom stall situation. There's a story about how these anti-union slogans are following workers into the bathroom. Well, in reality, it's sort of like they always have some kind of announcement in the stall just so you can, you know, find out what's going on while you're doing your business. Well, now it says do it without dues. And the idea is that Amazon says the union that's trying to represent these workers has been on a decline. All they just want to do is take this money. One worker I spoke with who voted no from Bessemer, she said her big concern is she alleges that, you know, she would ask these organizers what they were planning to do with her dues money, and that allegedly they told her they wanted to take that money and organize other warehouses. So that's kind of how that's played out there, is less about, I mean, Amazon has attempted to sort of argue that the dues money will, you know, just buy nice things for the union, just very classic kind of argument, but that also has played out as like, will they just take this money in order to organize other warehouses? Of course, the workers who are pro-union keep reminding people that, you know, they were the ones who reached out to the union. They were the ones who originated this whole idea. And at the end of the day, to your point, it is a right to work state. So if you don't want to pay dues, you know, the union can't require you to.
Travis, any of that going on at the state? Any discouragement from management to vote?
No, not at all. And that's why we think that McClatchy should move forward with voluntary recognition from us, because we're doing this in an atmosphere of mutual respect. But listen, we have a lot smaller of a group here. You're talking about 5,000-6,000 people down at Amazon. We're talking about 30 people, right? Okay. So it's a lot different of an atmosphere. But those conversations did happen as we were organizing our newsroom. What about dues? What do you do with dues? Well, you know, the studies are out there. They show that organized workers make more money. Like, we can get guaranteed raises, you know, through a contract, which will, you know, make the dues mean nothing. Like, we're paying to get paid more, you know, and like, we're paying to get legal representation, you know, like the dues are negligible to the benefits we get. That was conversations we had internally, though, between reporters. Those aren't conversations that are coming from management.
Just as newspapers have fallen on hard times, and actually media in general has fallen on hard times, so have American workers in recent years. It's no secret that the middle class is declining and that the 1% is getting most of the money, and that raises for the workers pale in comparison. I mean, it's a joke to say to use the word pale in comparison to what executives are getting in terms of raises and compensation. But at the same time, this is going on, Dr. Korstadt. Unions have declined in membership. They're down to 11% of workers in America. Is this a chicken and an egg thing? Are we witnessing the decline of the middle class because of decline in unions? And if not, why would unionization membership decline in the face of hardships coming into middle class lives?
Yeah, I think a lot of the decline in, I mean, the relationship between the decline of the middle class and the decline of the unionization is very clear. As people have lost jobs and companies have moved abroad, those positions they're just not available to people, and fathers and grandfathers not able to pass these things along to their heirs. The other thing I think that's been really important is the role of the National Labor Relations Board over the last 20 or 30 years, and the way it's been very decidedly pro-business, pro-employer. Its rulings, its unwillingness to really take a stand and enforce a law. I mean, Amazon is violated, you know, it's got hundreds of claims against it for violating labor law. And so do most of, you know, Google and all the other big companies in this country. The same thing. And the procedure that was put in place in the 1930s to deal with those, to create a what was called a system of industrial jurisprudence, where workers had, you know, a place to go to when they felt like their rights had been trampled on. You know, business has been able to control that mechanism and to really restrict it. And I think that's compounded the decline of unionization in the United States.
We have the example of the McClatchy organization saying yes to unions at the Hilton Head Island Packet and the Beaufort Gazette. Now, obviously, the number of employees who work there who are unionized now is minuscule in comparison to what happened at Amazon. But newspapers are in dire straits at the moment, and yet they welcomed, they didn't fight unionization. Meanwhile, Amazon is owned by the richest person in the world, who also owns a major newspaper, the Washington Post, Jeff Bezos. Why would they vigorously fight this, particularly in light, Doctor, of the fact that they run unionized shops in France, in Italy, in Spain, and in Germany, where unions hold sway, period, end of conversation? Why would they fight this in America?
Well, I think that there are a lot of reasons. I think it's part of the corporate culture that unions are bad, that management has rights to determine, you know, who works there, what conditions they work under. I think some of it's tied in their minds to profitability, that they, if they don't have exercise control over the workplace and are able to stretch out people's hours and their work and stuff, that the profitability is just not there. So I think that, it's a combination of things. And, you know, it's also, it's like, how much money does Jeff Bezos need? I mean, how much money do these corporations to really need? I mean, there's a kind of level of greed here that's, I think, that plays a role in this. And I think that's one of the things that motivates workers to want to unionize. You know, they see this kind of wealth out there and they feel like they're helping create that. Why aren't they sharing in that?
Is part of the reason people are interested in what may happen in Alabama at Amazon because it's a bellwether of what may be to come in terms of unionizing workers all across the country in other industries? And if so, why? Because we've become a kind of gig economy where people can't really be I don't think they can really be unionized. Alina, is that even something that we can even talk about, the unionization of gig workers? And wouldn't companies threaten to move in that direction where everybody who works for us will be a gig worker, therefore you won't be covered by a union?
One of the groups within the Amazon universe that, you know, a lot of reporters like me are watching are the drivers. So you've probably have noticed in the last few years, the fleets of Amazon delivery vans and trucks have really exploded. And many of them are driven by drivers who are not direct employees of the company. They're contractors through smaller companies that, you know, get hired by Amazon. Some of them are direct employees. It's a very complicated universe of employees and contractors. And the labor organizers are putting a huge effort to try to organize that group of people. It has been historically, I mean, within Amazon, but also the broader retail world, it has been historically quite difficult to unionize this group of people because the turnover is extremely high. Mm-hmm. You are talking about people who come and work for a year or two and then move on. Same with fast food. And so the question of whether this becomes a bellwether, if this union is a go, I think is a really, really big one. And it would fundamentally change the procedures and how Amazon works.
And we expect a result on that vote in Alabama within a week. When will you know at the state newspaper, Travis, very quickly?
We hope to know very soon.
Okay. Travis Bland is with the state newspaper in Columbia. They have asked for a union. Robert Korstad is professor of public policy and history at Duke University. And Alina Seljuk is a business correspondent who covers this for NPR. Thank you all for the hour. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.